I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Republicans need to pick up 10 seats to gain control of the Senate, and their chances of doing that could hinge on what happens in Senate races in California and Washington state, at least according to New York Times political soothsayer Nate Silver. Polling shows that Democrats in both those races hold a slight edge, with incumbent Barbara Boxer leading 51-46% over Republican challenger Carly Fiorina in California. And in Washington state, Democratic Senator Patty Murray is in the fight of her political life against Dino Rossi, a former state legislator and real estate investor. Right now, Murray is ahead by a slim margin, 52-48%. So let's take a closer look at Washington state today, where all the voting is done by mail, so some ballots have already been cast. Jim Bruner of the Seattle Times joins us. Jim, welcome.
Hi.
And let's review the candidates. Patty Murray famously ran for the Senate as a soccer mom in tennis shoes back in 1992. She's on the Appropriations Committee. She brings home the bacon. Her supporters call her the fairy godmother for her federal funding for ferries, but her opponents call her the pork godmother. So start there. How has that affected this campaign?
Well, Patty Murray is on the Appropriations Committee, and she does use that position to bring millions and millions and millions of dollars to Washington State in earmarks, and that has been a big part of this campaign. One of the first promises by her opponent, Dino Rossi, was to ban earmarks, but Patty Murray has defended them staunchly, saying that you want somebody like me in Congress who knows your local community and can bring home money for roads and, like you mentioned, ferries and other projects. So it's been a big sticking point in this race.
Well, and as we said, it's a tight one, but Democratic political royalty has rolled into town. Barack Obama, First Lady Michelle Obama, Vice President Joe Biden, Bill Clinton. Has that helped or hurt?
Well, it's been quite the troop here recently, yeah. This is all about, for Patty Murray, bringing out the base. The polls show that independents are going to split mostly toward Dino Rossi, so she needs to make sure that she gets out all those people who voted for Barack Obama in 2008, and he's been here to remind people that they need to come out and vote for her if they want to keep advancing his agenda.
And is that one of those places where his appearance has helped, do you think, or hard to tell?
I think it helps in King County and Seattle. He won nearly 58% of the vote in Washington state. He's still more popular here than in some other places. So I think it gives her a boost among the base.
Well, Dino Rossi, the Republican, a former state senator, as we said, what has his message been to voters other than she spent too much?
That's the gist of it. He's been very focused. He doesn't give many details on other issues. He's fairly socially conservative, but it's something that he doesn't talk about. He says he wouldn't sponsor bills on abortion and things like that. So it has been about earmarks. It's been about the deficit, about what he calls reckless spending that's going to jeopardize futures of every succeeding generation.
Well, and those are the talking points this year. Well, your paper, the Seattle Times, has a great feature called The Truth Needle. It does a reality check on claims by candidates. So let's look at a couple. First, an anti-Rossi ad. It touches on the huge debate in the state over whether hometown favorite Boeing should be given some special consideration in Air Force contracts over its European rival Airbus. Let's listen.
When Dino Rossi was asked if Boeing workers should have a level playing field, he said,
No, not as far as I'm concerned, no.
Dino doesn't get it.
Okay, Jim Bruner of the Seattle Times. This gets very complicated, but your paper gave that truth needle a false. So why?
The underlying issue is fairly complicated to do with, you know, subsidies that Airbus has received in Boeing. But the underlying fact isn't really disputable. When you hear that answer that Rossi gave, he wasn't really asked that question that the Murray ad claims he was asked. And, you know, in Washington state, there really is no debate over Boeing. Nobody here is out there, certainly running for office, saying we're against Boeing. And so for the Murray campaign to claim that Dino Rossi was somehow anti-Boeing was just blatantly false and an exaggeration.
And after the interview, he said he meant subsidies to Boeing shouldn't be considered in a contract decision. But it, as you said, it gets kind of netty. Well, then there's this ad from the National Republican Senatorial Committee painting Senator Murray, Patty Murray, as a reckless spender.
Facing soaring debt, Senator Murray voted to waste billions on Wall Street bailouts, a failed stimulus that didn't create jobs, and a $1 trillion health care debacle.
Again, your needle went to false. Why?
Well, we focused on the stimulus claim, and there's been a lot of talk this year across the country, people claiming the stimulus spending by the federal government didn't create jobs. And yet when you look at the reports that have looked at it, it did create jobs. I mean, the whole point was it was spending to kind of prop up the economy. And while those might be temporary jobs, it's not a permanent solution necessarily, it did create jobs. To say it didn't create any is just false. To argue that it didn't bring us out of the recession is another thing, but to say it didn't create any jobs is just not true.
Well, Jim Bruner, there in Washington State, you have mail-in voting. As we said, that means we may not know after Election Day who won, if it's razor sharp. And Dino Rossi is already saying that he will ask for recount if it is razor sharp, because he's been in some gubernatorial races that were pretty close. So just in the few seconds we have, this could be a while before we even know what happens in Washington.
People have to have their ballots postmarked by Election Day here, so it's often a week till we know. And yeah, Dino Rossi faced a recount in lawsuits in 2004, so he's been through this before, and he's getting ready to possibly go through it again.
We may have to wait. Jim Bruner of the Seattle Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, Washington State also has one of the most interesting ballot questions this year, Income Tax Initiative 1098. Now, some background. Washington is one of several states that doesn't have an income tax, and 1098 would establish one, but just on individuals making over $200,000 and couples and families making over $400,000. Here's an ad against Initiative 1098 from a consortium of business people.
Tired of paying too little in taxes? Wish more could come out of your pocket for life? Well, Initiative 1098 has a scheme for you. It's a state income tax. It slices, dices, and can be extended to you in just 2 years. But
oh,
wait.
Don't you love political season? But Bill Gates Sr., the father of one of the wealthiest men in the world, is also pictured in an ad supporting 1098 as he's about to be dropped into a dunk tank.
Some people say Initiative 1098 is about soaking the rich. But it's really about doing something for the next generation. You see, state cutbacks have put our kids at risk. And we can't just sit here and do nothing about it. 1098 will dedicate $2 billion a year for education and health care. And only the wealthiest 1.2% will pay more.
So that's for and again, Prop 1098 in the state of Washington as Bill Gates Sr. goes into the water. There are 160 measures on the ballot in 37 states, over 100 referred by legislatures, 42 citizens initiatives, and questions from other sources like required constitutional questions. Let's take a look at some of them today with Jenny Drage Bowser, senior fellow at the National Conference of State Legislatures, a bipartisan group serving state legislatures. She joins us from her office in Denver. And Jenny, let's start with the Washington ballot. It seems to be a state taking the debate over whether to end the Bush tax cuts for the rich into its own hands. What more would 1098 do?
Well, it would take the revenue that would be raised by this increased tax and direct it to cuts in the state property tax and the business and occupation tax, and then any additional revenue after that would go toward health and education programs in the state.
And how's it going over? We heard the two ads, but what are people saying?
Well, the latest poll I saw had 51% of voters opposing the measure and 42% supporting it.
And so it seems that even though it's only imposing a tax on the very wealthy, the sentiment right now is running against it.
It does appear that way. And incidentally, this is not the first time Washington has voted on an income tax like this. Back in 1932, at the height of the Great Depression, voters approved an income tax in Washington, but it was later held unconstitutional by the state court.
And just briefly, what's the for and against? Do the people who are against it think it's a slippery slope to an income tax on all?
Yes, that's exactly the argument.
And are those who are for it generally agreeing with Bill Gates Sr.?
Generally agreeing with Bill Gates Sr. that those who make more can afford to pay more, and it will go towards health and education and all these things. Yeah.
Well, you write that if there is a dominating issue this year, it is questions about the economy and taxes. So let's take a look at other states proposing tax changes. Here in Massachusetts, we have two measures on the ballot. Question one would repeal a recently enacted sales tax on alcohol. Question three would cut the state sales tax from 6.25% to 3%. But what's happening in other states? Colorado has three tax and spending measures. Outline those for us.
We do. We have Amendment 60 and 61 and Proposition 101. Amendment 60 would cut our property tax rates in half. And, of course, that's the revenue that primarily funds K-12 education. So this amendment would also require the state to replace that lost income to school districts, but it does not provide a revenue source for the state to do that. Mm. Amendment 61 would prohibit all state borrowing, so things like bonding for infrastructure projects would be prohibited after 2010 in Colorado. It would also prohibit local government from borrowing unless it's approved by voters. And once all currently outstanding borrowing is repaid, which is a total of about $1.1 billion, it would require that tax rates be lowered. And then Proposition 101, this one changes state law, and it would cut the state income tax rate from 4.63% to 3.5% over about a decade, and it also either reduces or eliminates most motor vehicle and telecommunications taxes and fees.
Whoa, these are a lot of cuts. Three different questions there in Colorado, and I know there have been estimates as to how much revenue will be lost. Tell us about that.
Well, the estimate is that once all three of these are fully implemented, which would take about a decade, that the state would be required to spend about 99% of its general fund on K-12 education expenses, and $38 million would be left for all other general fund expenses. And that's things like higher education, corrections, human services and health programs, just about everything else.
Well, and it would seem that that's impossible math. I mean, we're hearing that the Colorado Legislative Council estimates that these three measures together would reduce state revenues by $2.1 billion.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, and so how are these questions faring?
They're not faring very well. The most recent poll from just about a week ago had the two amendments at 18% yes and the proposition at 21%.
Well, why don't you briefly just hopscotch on different tax and budget measures across the country?
Sure. Missouri is another state where voters face a couple of revenue-cutting initiatives. Constitutional Amendment 3 would prohibit the future imposition of any real estate sale or transfer tax. Missouri doesn't currently have a tax like that. It would just say you can't ever add one. And then another one that's significant in Missouri is Proposition A. That would impact local governments. Right now, there are two cities in Missouri, St. Louis and Kansas City, that impose an earnings tax. And what Proposition A would do was say no other local government can impose an earnings tax, and voters in St. Louis and Kansas City next year would need to vote to approve their earnings tax in order to continue it. And if they ever vote against continuing the earnings tax, it can never come back. So this would be a significant cut to revenue for local governments in those two cities, and it would cut off a future source of revenue to other local governments in Missouri.
And an earnings tax, by the way, is a tax you pay on the money you earn to the locality where you earn it. So if you worked in Kansas City but live elsewhere, your earning tax would go to KC. This applies, by the way, to pro athletes and people who come to town to work in conferences. Fascinating. We're talking about ballot initiatives with Jenny Drake Bowser of the Bipartisan National Conference of State Legislatures. South Carolina and Virginia would require their states to have more money in rainy day funds. In Maine, the city of Portland has a measure to give legal immigrants who are not citizens the right to vote in city elections. We're going to have more with Jenny when we come back. Also later today, Halloween goes retro. Will you be sending out a mini madman this year? We'd love to hear your costume ideas. Go to hereandnow.org and click on the little costume on the right-hand side of the page. Let us know. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about referendums and voter initiatives on the ballot on November 2nd. We're talking with Jenny Drage Bowser, senior fellow at the Colorado-based National Conference of State Legislatures. That's a bipartisan group serving state legislatures. And Jenny, let's pick up with State Question 756 in Oklahoma. It would allow residents to get out of federally imposed health care mandates. Take us through health reform-related measures.
Besides Oklahoma, next Tuesday, Colorado and Arizona voters will see a very similar measure on their ballot. What they do is add health care choice as a constitutional right, and they prohibit the state from requiring or enforcing any requirement to participate in any health coverage plan, and they restrict the state from limiting a person's ability to pay directly for health care services.
But we know there are questions about this in Oklahoma, for instance. The state attorney general's office put language into the ballot question 756, reminding voters that it's federal, not state law, that is the supreme law of the land. So how's this going to play out?
Under the U.S. Constitution's Supremacy Clause, federal law preempts state law. And what this likely means is that a state law along these lines can't override the Federal Affordable Health Care Act. It's a question, ultimately, that will be decided by the courts. But what it remains, regardless of what the courts say, is a symbolic statement about voters' feelings, either toward the federal health care reform law or perhaps over the broader issue of states' rights in general.
Well, let's take a look at another measure from California that's being watched across the country. This is Prop 23, and this would call for suspending that state's Global Warming Act of 2006. Now, that law was a landmark law. It required greenhouse gas emissions to be lowered to 1990 levels by 2010. Prop 23, now on the ballot in California, calls for suspending that emissions requirement law until the unemployment rate in the state is lowered. Now, people who are behind Prop 23 include Texas oil companies and a petrochemical company controlled by the Koch brothers. In fact, about three-quarters of the money to pass the measure is coming from the Koch brothers and these Texas oil companies. But opponents who want to stick with the requirement to reduce greenhouse gases are outspending the supporters by almost 2-1. Here are ads from both sides. Let's begin with the California Jobs Initiative ad. This is, again, a coalition of transportation, energy, and forestry companies. Again, they are for Prop 23 against emissions requirements.
I have enough bills, but now the politicians are putting a new energy tax on us to pay for California's global warming plan. Yes on 23 stops the energy tax, preventing a 60% increase in electricity rates and higher gas prices, and saves more than 1 million jobs. I want to do my part on global warming. All Yes on 23 says is, let's wait until people are back to work.
So again, those are people who are for Prop 23. People against include business and environmental organizations, the National Wildlife Federation, and here's an ad from Californians to Stop the Dirty Energy Proposition.
Our mission at the American Lung Association is to protect public health and the air we breathe. That's why we're strongly opposed to Proposition 23. Prop 23 is backed by two Texas oil companies that are among the worst polluters in California. They designed 23 to repeal portions of our health and safety code, which would result in more air pollution and more cases of asthma and lung disease. Please join the American Lung Association in voting no on Prop 23.
Jenny Drage Bowser, this has been a very emotional question in California. The governor spoke out very publicly, very angry about outside money coming in to influence the question. But what is the polling showing?
Well, there's still a large segment of the voting population in California that's undecided on this one. 19% in the most recent poll said they were undecided. But the majority of those would have to go to the yes camp for it to pass. Right now, it's 48% opposed and 32% support the measure.
Well, let's move on to some of the other questions being raised on the ballot this year. You point out that social issues aren't as much on the ballot as, for instance, when gay marriage was on so many ballot questions. But there is Amendment 62 in Colorado. It would define a fertilized egg as a person. Tell us more about this question.
Well, what it does is apply the term person in the Colorado Bill of Rights, the sections dealing with inalienable rights, equality of justice, and due process of law. It would apply the term person in those sections to every human being, quote, from the beginning of biological development.
And what would be the significance of this question if it passed?
It would make all forms of abortion illegal, and there are quite a lot of questions about what the other effects of this would be. There are questions pertaining to women's health issues and how this might impact certain kinds of birth control or decisions, say in the case of an ectopic pregnancy, things like that. And then obviously there are all of these other questions associated with the rights assigned then to fetuses.
There's another category of ballot question having to do with governance. Give us some of the samples of governance. We know in Illinois, Measure 31 would seek to establish a procedure for recalling a governor. Remember, a former governor of Illinois is Rod Blagojevich. What are some of the questions of governance?
The Oregon legislature would like to meet annually. Right now, they only meet every other year. They'd like to have annual sessions. The Alaska legislature would like to expand in size by about 10%. In Michigan and North Carolina, there are questions dealing with felons running for office.
I'm going to jump in with two you point out. In South Dakota, Amendment K, and Utah, Amendment A, people are presented with a question that would guarantee the right to vote by secret ballot. And my reaction was, they don't already have that?
when you vote in a statewide election, yes, of course, you still vote by secret ballot, but these have an additional component on them that pertains to labor union elections.
Ah, and there are a lot of questions about card voting regarding labor unions on ballots this year. Well, meanwhile, we just have to ask you about a couple in Oklahoma. Voters in Oklahoma will be asked to declare that English is the state's official language, but also they have a question that would ban the use of Sharia law. Is that a big problem in Oklahoma?
Not that I know of. That's the first time I've seen that issue appear on a statewide ballot. The English question has made quite a few appearances over the years. At least 9 states have considered that as a constitutional amendment on their ballot. And all 9 states, by the way, have approved it.
That's Jenny Drage Bowser, senior fellow from the National Conference of State Legislatures, a bipartisan group serving state legislatures. We'll link you to all sorts of information on our website, hereandnow.org, because there is so much to consider next Tuesday. Jenny, thanks so much.
Sure, my pleasure.
Expect Snooki, the Jersey Shore reality show star, Lady Gaga, who will need no introduction, and Steven Slater, the JetBlue steward who gave an expletive-deleted sign-off to passengers before sliding down the emergency slide with a couple of beers, to all make appearances on Halloween. These are reportedly some of the most popular costumes for adults this year. The National Retail Federation expects that, on average, Americans will spend about $66 on Halloween paraphernalia, most of it going to their costumes. And according to the Baltimore Sun, many people are going to vintage retailers. Angela Grube owns Ninth Life. That's a vintage clothing store in Baltimore's Hamden neighborhood. Angela, are you seeing more people going retro?
Yes, indeed. Very, very much so. A lot of from the 70s, some great 80s items are being picked up.
Which ones? Which ones?
They really aren't being too specific. They kind of just want everyday styles from the decades. I do see a lot of 80s prom dresses moving.
Really?
Yeah.
What would you pick up from the 70s? I'm trying to think. Except for bell bottoms, maybe.
Yeah, pretty much, like a disco or a party or any of the polyester lovely little dresses.
Oh, sure. And how about the 60s? Because, of course, you have Mad Men.
Yes, that is a very big one, actually. That has been for the past year, last year also.
So if you're a guy, you can just get, like, a box-cut suit.
Very, very true. And a skinny tie, and you're all set to go.
We understand Mad Men is hard to get.
A lot of people don't realize that Mad Men was done in, you know, the era for the show is the late 1950s to the early 1960s, and it's 2010. So that means these clothes are, you know, upwards of 50 years old, and in that time frame, the clothes were made from more natural fibers, so they don't last as long.
Wow, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. So what else are you seeing?
Some little odds and ends, you know, some people want to be everyday characters that have been turned into a zombie, or a lot of space girls, getting so many space girls.
Really?
Again, with the silver. Yeah, they want ray guns and silver dresses and crazy boots.
Now, do you think that's a little Lady Gaga, maybe?
You know, that definitely does go along the lines of Lady Gaga. Maybe they, you know, probably want to do Lady Gaga, or just not straight Lady Gaga, but are taking a lot of inspiration from her outfits.
Or Britney Spears on Glee. With that kind of bustier thing she had on.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
What advice would you give to people who, you know, maybe are going to run to a vintage store? What's just 3 items you can grab and do something quick?
Disco. Definitely disco. A lot of places have 70s clothing. Polyester dresses. Being a housewife, little dresses, easy. Men's, any crazy print, button-ups can work very well for numerous costumes.
And why do you think it is that, you know, instead of the prepackaged, people are still coming to a vintage clothing store like yours? Because we understand that this is a popular thing in the Hamden neighborhood.
We have a lot of very original people in this neighborhood, and you don't want to show up at a party dressed like everybody else. Halloween's time to go all out.
And what about you? What are you going to be this Halloween?
I have a 3-year-old, so I'm actually going to be from the cartoon Avatar: The Last Airbender.
Oh, how are you going to do that?
I hand make all of our costumes every year.
So a skin tight blue jumpsuit. I'm imagining.
Oh no, not that. It's not that one. It's actually a cartoon on Nickelodeon.
Oh, pardon me. And so, what does this look like?
It's very laid back, like robe costumes and such.
Ah.
The main character was a monk, so
more Star Warsy.
Yeah, actually, yeah, that's right along those lines.
Mm-hmm. And what about the 3-year-old?
He's going to be in a orange and yellow monk getup. He's the little main character of the story.
Excellent. That's Angela Grube, owner of Ninth Life, a vintage clothing store in the Hamden neighborhood of Baltimore, which is very active this time of year. Angela, thanks, and have fun.
Thanks, you also.
And another costume news, judging by the blogs, many people would be going as Senate candidate Christine O'Donnell, which means they wouldn't be going as a witch, they'd have to be going as you. O'Donnell herself says she's thinking of going as Dorothy, because Dorothy, of course, killed the witch. Popular costumes for kids include perennial favorites, princesses and pirates, vampires. And as we said, Snooki from the Jersey Shore will be popular. Now, we're going to link you to a website that teaches you how. They suggest you buy a can of hairspray and grab someone who grew up in the 80s to help with the hair. Orange body paint is a must as well, that whole tanning thing. We'll have that at hereandnow.org. Back in a bit with the Velasquez in the basement, Here and Now. It's such a fantasy. You're poking around in the basement and you find a major work of art. Well, that happened to John Marchari in late 2004 when he was a curator at the Yale University Art Gallery. He came across a painting in the gallery's storage facility labeled The Education of the Virgin. The style looked familiar. It should have. Turned out it's undoubtedly a Velasquez. And now Spain has gone wild at the prospect of a new masterpiece by a national icon. John Marchari writes about the Velasquez in the basement in a recent issue of the Yale Alumni Magazine. He's now with the San Diego Museum of Art and joins us from the University of San Diego. John, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's great to talk to you.
Take us through this story. When you first saw it, of course, you hadn't done all the research you've done subsequently, but still, what was there? Was there sort of a hair lifting on the back of your arm moment?
Well, there was, but it wasn't the initial moment.
Right.
The first time I saw it, I thought, wow, that's fascinating. But I can't say that I knew what it was or even that I had any ideas straight off.
Well, but describe the painting, because there were some things you did see. So describe it. It was also in poor condition, which sort of robbed you of that, maybe that Hosanna moment. But describe it.
Well, it's large. It's about 5.5 by 4.5 feet now in its cut-down state. It shows at the center a young girl in a pink robe learning to read from a woman seated at the right side of the canvas with an old man leaning in from the left. And at the top of the canvas, the praying arms of what seems to be an angel whose head is missing.
Right.
At the time, moreover, there was a bit of tissue paper holding some loose paint in place. There were and still are great areas of paint loss on the canvas.
But still, even in looking at it, there's a light falling on the little girl's face. That's, as you say, there was a serenity to it. There was something there.
Exactly. So the first time I saw it, although no lightning bolts went off that gave me a name to associate with it, I thought that despite its damage, this was a painting worth spending some time with. This was a painting that was a work of great quality and that was, in the way curators put it, attributable. This was by someone. This was good enough and individual enough that with some work, I thought right from the start, it could be attributed to some known master.
So you constantly now go back and look at it, you study it, and then there was a moment. Tell us about that moment.
Perhaps 2 or 3 months after the very first time I saw it, I was looking at it, and suddenly everything clicked into place. And I thought, wait a minute, I know exactly what this is. This is early Velasquez. This is just like the great tavern scene at the Hermitage. This is like those pictures in London at the National Gallery in Apsley House. This is like the St. Thomas in Orleans. This is like everything that was in this exhibition, Velasquez in Seville, that had taken place in Edinburgh in the late 90s.
There were things like the drapery and heavy folds.
Exactly. Yeah. Everything suddenly seemed familiar. The way the draperies were arranged in these heavy, almost abstract folds, the color palette of the picture, the extreme naturalism. At the left side of the picture, there's a tabletop with a bowl and some still life elements that are just like those in the other pictures. Even some of the models in the picture looked familiar. They looked to be the same people who had served as models for other paintings by the young artist.
Well, and when you mention that, the Yale Alumni Magazine has, of course, a picture of the Education painting. There's the two figures with the little girl in the middle. And a couple pages later, Velasquez's tavern. Oh, my gosh! The guy on the left side of the tavern table looks exactly like the older man in Education. I mean, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's the one that, right from the start, that was the picture that was the primary reference point. And I think it is the same man. I think that Velázquez, in this revolutionary moment of naturalism coming into his paintings, insisted on painting directly from live models. And so this man who had served as the model for one painting would have served as the model for another painting done, I don't know, weeks, months, perhaps a year at most later.
Well, just to even see those two images side by side, the two men, or the same man, that must have been so exciting.
Well, you know, it was this fantastic moment in which at once I was incredibly excited, and then at the same time telling myself that it just couldn't be. It was too impossible. There was no way that I had just found Velázquez sitting in the storerooms where it had been at a major research university for, at the time, I thought 100 years. It turns out to have been there for about 80.
Yeah. I mean, because after all, one of the greatest painters in the European tradition, he influenced Manet, Picasso and Dali have paid him tribute. He was court painter for Philip IV of Spain. I mean, just, I mean, it couldn't be have been sitting there. But you start to do the detective work. You take it to people who process the paint and the even with an X-ray can see the brush styles.
None of that technical evidence can prove that it's Velázquez, but it could easily have disproven the theory if things didn't check out.
You also try to get expert opinions without giving too much away. For instance, at one point you email a photo to a colleague, and he writes back what?
About 30 seconds later, his reply came to the email, and it begins with the words, "I am trembling," followed by a line of exclamation points. You know, no doubt about it. It's Spanish, Seville. I must see it. I have a name in mind, but I'm afraid to say it. Because, of course, it is so insane a thing to suggest that you've found a lost Velázquez.
Yeah. And it pretty much has been accepted, hasn't it, that this is a Velázquez?
There are a number of major scholars in Spain who have come out publicly in favor of the attribution. There are others who have told me in private that they are convinced, and yet there are still others who are not convinced and who think that all of us in support of the painting are seeing things that aren't there. So the scholarly opinion remains divided and will still take, I think, years to be settled. These things tend to go back and forth for quite a long time, and some never get resolved.
Well, John Marchari, pretty much, though, this is being accepted as the Velázquez in the basement. What does this mean for you? I mean, where do you go from here? It doesn't feel as if, you know, it's you might as well just retire, you know?
Because... Well, you know, I think I can safely say I don't expect that I will ever in my life discover a painting that is anywhere near as important as this one is. On the other hand, the work that went into this is the same work I do most days. It's just that very few of the artists can carry the media impact that the name Velázquez can.
Yeah. John Marchari, now curator of European art at the San Diego Museum of Art, but speaking of his discovery of the Velázquez in the basement at Yale, we'll link you to his article in the Yale Alumni Magazine. John, thank you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Imagine our world if the United States did control the two largest proven oil reserves in Saudi Arabia and the Canadian tar sands. Her power would be greater than anything we can imagine.
We asked you for your picks for favorite political films. That suggestion came into hereandnow.org from R.O. Mitz. It's the 2008 Canadian miniseries The Trojan Horse. Colleen Kieran likes the HBO miniseries K Street. And Wag the Dog was a favorite of many of you. Now, who can forget Dustin Hoffman as the Hollywood director reacting to a proposition from a political operative played by Robert De Niro?
You want me to produce your war? Not a war. It's a pageant. We need a theme, a song, some visuals. We need, you know, it's a pageant. It's like the Oscars. That's why we came to you.
Wag the Dog was also on Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr's list of top political films when we spoke with him before the presidential election. Well, we bring you that list again. Let's start with a classic. You recommend Preston Sturges' 1940 film, The Great McGinty.
Well, Preston Sturges was one of the great writer-directors of early Hollywood. And this is actually one of the more cynical movies about the electoral process. It's about a bum who becomes governor of New York. Brian Donlevy plays a depression homeless guy who votes about 10 times in one election because he gets, you know, a free piece of bread every time he does. So he comes to the attention of the party boss, played by Akeem Tamaroff. And they realize that, you know, he looks good, that he's a patsy, and so election by election, he ends up in the governor's mansion of, well, the state is not said, but it's clearly New York. And then, to his horrible discredit, falls in love with the secretary and becomes a nice guy. But for most of the movie, it's this hilariously cynical take on what it takes to get ahead in politics in America, and it really holds up beautifully.
You'll have to kiss a lot of babies, squeeze a lot of meats, wear your old clothes. They don't want no dudes after Tillinghast. I'll tell Jarvis about it. Oh, another thing. You gotta get married right away.
What do you mean, get married right away?
What do you think it means? Women got the vote now. Maybe you didn't hear about it. They don't like bachelors.
A scene from The Great McKinty from Preston Sturges in 1940. And by the way, we're going to have Tyburn's whole list at our website, here-now.org. Let's move on to Frank Capra, of course, a director that people think about when they think about Americana, It's a Wonderful Life, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But you're recommending a less-known film, State of the Union.
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is the movie that you should see if you want to buy or rebuy into all those noble, wonderful ideals about our electoral process. State of the Union is a post-war film from Capra. It's much less hopeful, although it ends, because it's Capra, he has to end well. He can only take his cynicism so far. Spencer Tracy plays a big businessman who's running for president. He's separated from his wife, Katharine Hepburn, and he's having an affair with a newspaper woman played by Angela Lansbury, a young and very devious Angela Lansbury.
Well, let's listen to a scene from State of the Union with Angela Lansbury. Here she is with Adolphe Manjou, who plays a political power broker who doesn't understand why she's helping Spencer Tracy's character run for president.
You know, I know about your father and the Republican Party.
You also know that they've given me the beautiful brush off ever since. On occasions, they've even seen fit to describe the support of my newspapers as the kiss of death. Well, I thought if I could present the country and the Republican Party with the next president of the United States, it would give me more than a little pleasure to see certain heads roll.
It's a movie about what you have to give up if you want to become president. You know, and that's what a lot of these election movies are about. What do you have to give up if you want to get there and do the things you want to do? And because it's Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn's on the sidelines, you know, urging him to do what's right, we kind of know where it's going. But it's great fun seeing, you know, where it goes.
Okay. Robert Altman makes a couple of appearances on your list. First for the 1975 film Nashville. You know, people think country music. No, you say politics.
Oh, absolutely. This is a movie made in 1975. Nixon had left office. Everything seemed up in the air. The 1976 presidential election was gearing up. And this is a movie that said entertainment is politics and politics is entertainment. It was one of the first to really articulate that directly. And yes, it's set in Nashville. It's about the country music industry. But weaving throughout the entire film is a candidate's van for Hal Philip Walker of the Replacement Party. You never see him. You only hear his voice on this van.
There is no question about being involved. The question is what to do. It is the very nature of government to strain at a gnat and swallow a camel.
Various characters in the movie are for him, they're against him, but that van sets a political line throughout the entire movie that eventually pays off when one of the characters pulls out a gun and shoots one of the performers, and it's a political assassination. The movie frames it as a political assassination, and in the context of the movie, given everything that we know in 1975 that has happened from JFK's assassination up until that moment, it becomes this immense American tragedy in which politics and entertainment just come together and nothing seems to work. It's a really daring movie that really holds up quite well.
Okay, that's Nashville from Robert Altman. But another Altman work is Tanner 88. This was the HBO series in 1988. It was written by Gary Trudeau, political cartoonist, and followed another politician running for president, one of the first that uses actual political figures playing themselves.
Right. And that's something we see in a lot of movies now. Tanner 88 is sort of where it started. And this is one of the great works of political satire in American entertainment history. People don't really remember it because it was a TV series and it was a cable series back when HBO wasn't really known for doing that sort of thing. But it's out there on DVD. It still stings.
March 11th, 1988. I'd spent the day talking with contributors. Even after a year of such calls, it still amazes me how many ordinary citizens feel strongly enough about an election's outcome to give. Their faith lends much dignity to the whole process by which we choose our countries.
Dad, USA Today is on the other line.
They want to know, if you were a fruit or a vegetable, which one would you be?
Okay. Well, we've talked a lot about films with people running for office. You also picked the 1993 comedy Dave, starring Kevin Kline, as Dave Kovic, a man who makes a living impersonating President William Mitchell, and of course is pulled into the White House to impersonate the president.
Right. This is not about an election. It's about a sitting president. Well, in this case, actually a comatose president, because the president actually goes into a coma and the average guy who looks just like him has to end up impersonating him and actually turns out to be a better president and a better husband and a nicer guy than the nasty guy we elected. This, to my mind, is one of the more successful Capra-esque political films that has come out in the last 20 years. Everybody tries to make a good, feel-good, incisive Capra movie. That's the model. You know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is sort of the model. Dave is one I think that works, partially because you've got a great actor, Kevin Kline, portraying both a very, very nasty but effective president and also a regular guy. What would happen if you got into the White House? What would you do? That's what the movie's basically asking.
From today, I'm going to make it the responsibility of this government to find a job for every American who wants one.
A scene from Dave on Boston Globe critic Ty Burr's list of great political films. Ty, one last question. Do you think conservatives have a point? We've talked about this, that conservative presidents don't get represented in Hollywood movies in a good light. You know, that we see politics and the president and campaigns through the prism of liberal Hollywood.
I think you can take that too far, but I think there is some truth in it. I think the people who run Hollywood now, the executives and the directors, they all came of age in the 60s and 70s at a time when Hollywood was making movies that were really groundbreaking and different and dark. And so, yes, they are presenting movies that present their way of seeing the world. I also do think that there are some conservative movies that have been made. We've talked about this before, usually featuring, you know, lone heroes, but they don't directly address conservative presidents or the conservative side of the election process.